When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello listener, welcome to the Switch It podcast. We're all huddled under a blanket with a mug of hot drink. Not through catching a chill while standing in a damp field playing championship cricket in April, no, but because we've once again contracted World Cup fever, baby. Yes, it's less than 6 months since Australia and India contested the 50-over World Cup final in Ahmedabad, but already time to start gearing up for the competition formerly known as the World T20. England have this morning announced their squad to go to the Caribbean, and the defending champions will travel as one of the favourites. So far, so familiar. Joining me in the studio today to discuss such wildcard selections as all-time second-highest T20I wicket-taker for England, Chris Jordan, are a couple of white-hot white ballers, Matt Roller and Vish Hantaraja. But first up, let's hear from England Managing Director Rob Key on the return of Jofra Archer and the decision to bring all those selected back from the IPL to play next month's T20I series against Pakistan.
Jofra's that bowler that is just so special. You do everything you can to try and get him back playing. And we've sort of taken the longer road this time. But as always with Jofra, it's fingers crossed until he's out there playing. You know, like when you're waiting for something really good to happen, you know, you don't quite believe it till he's there. But he's tracking well at the moment. You know, the next step is when he gets into that Pakistan series is going to be full match intensity and how he keeps going through there. But at the moment, we're doing everything we can and he's in a good spot. Playing in Barbados, as you can imagine, is something that Jofra is desperate to do as well. So we're more than hopeful that he'll be playing that Pakistan series. And we're probably not going to go right. It's probably the same with all our bowlers. You know, you're going to make sure you get them through that series and then you're into the World Cup. And yeah, the start of it is quite good, actually. As much as it's a very quick turnaround from playing over here then straight into Barbados and then a game a few days later, then there's a little bit of time off. So we're hopeful and we're confident that he's going to be right.
In terms of the IPL, obviously you've named the same 15 for that Pakistan squad. That means, you know, you haven't named any extra players. You haven't given yourself the leeway of leaving someone if you think maybe going all the way in the IPL is an idea. So everyone's come in, everyone's sort of been travelling together as a team in that Pakistan series.
Yeah, I sort of left it open for a while and made everyone aware that there's a good chance they'll be called back and we're going to see how the land lay when we got to that. But now I think we're at that point where we think it's important that this team, because there's a few newer players coming into this side, that it's important that it gets together. You know, the likes of Phil Saltwell, Jacks have actually been around a little bit, but this is now very much their opportunity with a few others. So you just want them to get together and spend a bit of time and build up to it. So much of what our white ball team has done has been sort of turning up a couple of days before and bang, we're into a series. Whereas I think that Pakistan series is going to be important for that. So they'll all come back ready for that.
And is part of that a lesson from the last World Cup whereby maybe that squad didn't spend enough time together before they got out there? And, you know, that's maybe something you've tinkered with.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a fair few lessons that you learn. I think as well, really sort of trying to cement, you know, and it can always be fluid to some degree, but you want people to really start understanding what their roles are, what your best 11 is going to be. And that's what we want to make sure when we hit Barbados, we know exactly what that is. You know, we're trying to sort of work from that. Now, last time for the World Cup, I think Adil Rashid was injured in that series versus New Zealand. And we probably didn't take into account how much when he came back, then actually altered the balance a little bit. So, you know, we want to be pretty clear on the way we want to go from the start in this.
Matt, Vish, between you broke the news of this squad last night. Well done. Fair to say, Matt, that there weren't too many curveballs.
No, it's a slightly weird squad, I suppose, in some ways, isn't it? As you say, Jordan missed the Caribbean tour, which Wokes went on before Christmas. So a bit of a surprise to see Jordan in there and Wokes not. Key was saying this morning that he didn't see them as competing for the same spot because Wokes primarily takes the new ball and Jordan primarily bowls at the death. And Jordan's batting, he feels, might be better suited to the sort of power hitting that you need in the Caribbean. And then I suppose you do have some slightly, you know, we might have considered them left field 4 or 5 months ago, selections in an uncapped T20i player in Tom Hartley, who's got the nod over Rayan Ahmed, and then Ben Duckett as well as the spare batter. But I suppose in some ways most of that was somewhat worked itself out, because Rayan struggled a little bit at the back end of that Caribbean tour in the T20s, and Hartley obviously has impressed the England management across formats over the last 6 months, but particularly in India, it feels like. And then Duckett was probably the obvious man in. David Milan is now seemingly out of favour. Looks like his England career is done. And Ben Stokes made himself unavailable for selection a few weeks ago now. So England clearly needed a left-hander as their spare batter. And it looks like Duckett is the guy they've chosen. So, yeah, slightly weird one in that there are some picks that we probably would have considered quite left field in December when England last played a T20 match, but now look somewhat more predictable, I suppose.
Yeah, well, Hartley, definitely one to come to, uncapped in T20s, has a good record in that format for sort of Lancashire and Manchester Originals. Yeah, no Chris Wokes, who is a World Cup winner. The of those that won in Australia 2 years ago, obviously Ben Stokes had made himself unavailable. David Williak, Alex Hales have retired. David Milan overlooked. Tamal Mills as well. I mean, lots of excitement, Vish, about Jofra Archer being back in an England squad, but he hasn't actually played any cricket since pretty much this time last year at the IPL. And England aren't really going to know how ready he is for a World Cup until he gets through May, and whatever that entails in terms of turning out for Sussex or then hopefully playing in that Pakistan T20 series.
Yeah, it feels like a very unique conversation to him, doesn't it? Because when you think about the other fast bowlers that England have worked with over the last couple of years, they're not all that fussed about game time and overs into legs and stuff like that. I suppose that's a bit of a throwback view on how you should deal with fast bowlers. If you look at Mark Wood in particular as someone who they basically just want him for the stuff that matters, essentially. They don't necessarily need him to prove his fitness or get overs under his belt. With Jofra, it's a bit more about trusting his body, isn't it? And I suppose that's why it's so valuable having him, A, deemed fit enough for the 15, because it was only, you know, 6 or so months ago that he was supposed to be a reserve, a travelling reserve for the 50-over World Cup, and, well, he was on the ground for all of a week, if that. So it does sound, all that sounds quite promising. I think, yeah, you're only really going to know when he plays that first game against Pakistan, whenever that is, whether it's the opening T20i or further down the line in that particular series. But I think broadly, though, you step back and you think maybe England aren't as reliant on Archer being fit as they were in the past. Obviously, he was reserve, or, you know, touted as reserve in that 50-over World Cup. But it feels like they've got a very clear idea of how they're going into this particular World Cup and the conditions they're going to face in the Caribbean, because of that series in December. You know, Rob Key today in his press conference talked about that being a slugfest, and even posited the idea of going in with a three-pronged bowling attack, like bowling attack outright, not considering all-rounders. And that feels like it's a bit more progressive than maybe England's 50-over World Cup selection. Because on paper, you look at that squad, and the word that came to mind was healthy. Like, it just looks healthier. It looks a bit more balanced. There is a good core of youth there, but responsibility-taking youth. You think of someone like Will Jacks, who hasn't played in a ICC tournament for England. Do you look at him as someone devoid of experience? Not at all. He's someone who has shown the world over, is currently showing in India, that he can play well in all conditions. And even little things, the fact that he's got this absurd record of batting through an innings in T20s without necessarily being a player who slows down in any way, domestically and in domestic English white ball cricket and across the world as well. So, no, it looks really healthy. Obviously, there's issues to talk about with bowling potentially and who gets certain overs, but I mean, that's always the case in T20 cricket now. So, by and large, yeah, I think it's a pretty sound squad.
One of the players who is sadly not healthy and was being sort of touted for inclusion, Jamie Overton, Matt. That's where Jordan came back into the conversation in terms of his power hitting. Overton's had a good run kind of in competitions around the world, Big Bash and ILT20, I think, as well. And obviously, an untimely injury for him. And we don't really know the full extent of that yet, but it has ruled him out at this stage of the conversation.
Yeah, it's been a really weird one. He was asked about it today and, you know, said, as I think has been well established for a while, that England have been keen on him. They've been tracking him throughout the winter. He was the MVP at the 100 last year as well, which sort of slipped under the radar because his team lost in the final. But yeah, he had a really good sort of 6-7 months in T20 cricket. But his fitness record isn't great. And just before the Surrey's Championship game at Kent, he was actually named in the squad, but then clearly felt something in his back, went for some scans, came back inconclusive. And I think he's getting rescanned in probably about 10 days from now, but not quite enough certainty over his fitness that England wanted to name him at this stage. And I think the impression I've got throughout this past couple of weeks has been that England were quite keen to have a little bit, well, much more clarity on the selection process and the selection announcement than in the 50 over World Cup last year. I thought it was actually quite notable that Rob Key did the press conference today rather than Luke Wright, who did it last time, and I don't think has done any media duties announcing a squad since then. And it was very clear today, this is the squad for Pakistan T20s and the World Cup. Barring injury, that's pretty much it, which was not, that there was nowhere near that level of clarity last time in the 50 over World Cup. And obviously that ended with the whole sort of fiasco of Brooke initially being left out, Roy eventually sort of being deemed unselectable because of his back spasms. So yeah, it felt like, I don't know, it felt like a better managed process than last year. And I think from listening to Key speak, there's a fair bit of clarity, at least in terms of how the selectors, which obviously includes the captain and the coach, want England to play. They want to bat deep. They realise that batting is their strength and there's a lot of focus on power in the squad.
Yeah, like putting aside the fact that these are two different formats, I do wonder if this squad and just the conversations being had behind the scenes happen as they've happened had England not had the issues they did in India, you know, from start to finish. Because I don't necessarily think that, you know, having that squad and then the idea, you know, that original provisional squad that they announced at the end of last summer, and then having the idea that someone could break in, especially when that someone was Harry Brooke, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It was just the messaging throughout that. And then if you look at the squad overall, you know, it took, what, within 3 weeks of that to think, right, some of these players might never play for England again, because that's suddenly like that's how badly things have turned. And you look at the squad and the youth, you know, the youthfulness in it, and you were like, well, this feels a lot better. I do wonder, actually, if... the absurdity is, though, that the T20 World Cup happens far too often and the 50 over World Cup is in a, you know, familiar four-year structure. But you do wonder how much, I suppose, how quickly they, you know, the ECB, the management, talking specifically Rob Key, Luke Wright and even Joss Butler and Matthew Mott here, have learned from how bad an experience that was, yeah.
I suppose there's also, there's a lot more to go on, isn't there, in terms of T20 selection than there is for the one-day team these days, you know. List day cricket, they just don't really play it unless it's internationally. And in this case, I mean, the evolution of England's squad from that 2022 team, a lot of that is based around what is being done in franchise tournaments and kind of looking at the form of what's going to be England's top four. So, Matt, as you wrote, Joss Butler's got 100, 200 at the IPL. Will Jacks, Vish has just done that for RCB. Phil Salt's among the leading run scorers. Johnny Bairstow, who I think someone made a crazy suggestion that he should be brought home from the IPL for his own good.
To be fair, in Matt's defence, he is coming home early now, isn't he? Yeah,
exactly. Someone was listening. He obviously got back into form, having been dropped at Punjab Kings. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the thinking, I suppose, with having a World Cup following so closely on from the IPL is that players who are doing pretty well there should come into the tournament in good nick.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also, to some extent, we've seen both the importance and relative unimportance of T20 internationals in that England have clearly tried to use that series in the Caribbean to learn what style of cricket might be played in the World Cup and sort of how games might pan out. I think that series, if I'm not mistaken, the five games all went with the team that hit the most sixes, which seems like such a pretty obvious thing and often is the way in T20, but gives an indication as to what style of cricket might be played. But then also, if you look at, for example, you know, Jack's T20 international record for England is not very good. Mm. But England have got enough faith in the fact that they've seen him perform in, I think he's now scored hundreds in the 100, the BPL, the SA20 and the IPL in the past 18 months or so. They've got enough faith in his performances and those that they think his T20i average and strike rate are not a true reflection of the quality of player he actually is. And they trust the, you know, what they're seeing all the time throughout the winter. Because, yeah, if you just went off T20i's, then England haven't played for 5 months. No one has any form, but clearly they're pretty relevant.
Yeah, and that series in the Caribbean, there was, I think, there was some discussion around whether it would be sort of Salt or Jax as the opener. And a lot of the clarity has come. Well, Salt scored 200s at opening in that series.
Yeah.
Jax, as you say, yeah, 11 T20s, T20Is, high score of 40, average of 16. But been sort of doing it all around the world. Yeah.
And I mean, particularly that game on the weekend, obviously, you know, to some extent, the game was won by the time he went completely crazy. But I think he hit Rashid Khan for 5 boundaries in a row. To go to his 100, which is pretty incredible stuff. And I mean,
I think 28 off the over, but yeah, something like that.
It's obviously, you know, it's easy to, with the IPL this year, there's obviously been some huge scores and there's been a lot of flat tracks and sometimes the sixes all blur into one. But the idea of, you know, a guy who's, what, 25, walking out at the biggest cricket stadium in the world, batting with Virat at the other end and destroying Rashid Khan to reach his 100, it's pretty life-changing stuff. I'm sure he's going to come into this tournament with a huge amount of confidence, and he will have gained something from the experience, no doubt. Obviously, yeah, people talk about the intangibles of the IPL, and sometimes they're sort of slightly egged up by players who are sort of trying to justify why they're, you know, missing cricket for a big paycheck. But in Jax's case, I think that's a good example of someone having his first taste of the IPL and probably being a huge beneficiary from that.
Yeah, I mean, when you're that talented, I suppose it's tough life, isn't it? The guy's got, you know, he's been captain all 3 formats. He's got an IPL 100. He's done it in the 100, which is the second biggest stage. 3 first class 100s as well. I just want to focus on this now because I'm looking at his profile. But 25 years old, he's played 162 T20s.
Yeah.
That is crazy, yeah.
I mean, that's the way the game has changed in some ways.
But it's also important to consider that, the ECB handed out 26 central contracts last year, the end of last year. Jax was essentially 27.
Not to him, yeah.
And I believe during the process there was, you know, he was under the impression that he was getting one. So it's not like England have, you know, plucked this kid out of nowhere, as you know, you've just found out from reading the numbers yourself.
Someone should cap this guy. Yeah.
But the contracts is an interesting point, though, because of that squad, Salt doesn't have an England contract.
Yeah.
Jax doesn't have an England contract. Jordan doesn't have an England contract. I don't think Hartley has an England contract.
No.
David Milan does. So.
Yeah, and there was obviously this core. Key was sort of speaking towards the end of the World Cup about trying to have this core of multi-format fast bowlers, where he was talking about Atkinson, Carr, Potts, Turner, who, I don't know, maybe this is a longer-term project and it's unfair to judge 4 or 5 months down the line. I think Turner's only just coming back to fitness, for example. But it does definitely seem that, yeah, those contracts, which, you know, age like yellow label milk anyway, it's not got any better a few months on. There's some pretty weird ones in there.
Well, to be fair, like, the contract situation, it was always done with a view to, I suppose, for the ECB to have control over their most valuable assets.
Yeah.
Which are fast bowlers, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in, you know, when you say that, you know, obviously it's a valid point considering that David Milan has a contract, but when you think about the examples of Salt and Jax, probably earn more money than they would have certainly been able to get from the ECB in that round of contracts.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're in a situation now where the only reason they're getting pulled out of the IPL is to play in a World Cup.
Yeah.
It's kind of the best of that situation.
It's not like it's the end of the world for
either. No, no. And I suppose, like, you know, we'll be in a situation later this summer where we'll see kind of if there'll be as many contracts and B, who gets them.
Yeah.
But, you know, as with all these kind of contracts, which are, you know, looking to the future, like a lot of them age quite badly. Mm. Think of Rory Burns after the Ashes.
Yeah,
you know,
and I suppose that's
10 months on it.
They always say at the time, these are based on a combination of number of caps in the previous cycle, plus looking forward. And it's, I don't know. It is a difficult thing to get right because there's clearly a mechanism that is quite oblique, quite opaque. And
And in a rapidly changing landscape.
On,
I mean, one of those selection kind of head-to-heads that we mentioned, but Rehan Ahmed has been kind of the coming man, the youngest player to be capped England men in all formats, I think. He's a leg spinner, spins it both ways. He's a batter. He's a nighthawk, but he misses out here. And Tom Hartley, who did very well on the Test tour of India, comes in. Is that as much as anything to do with sort of role definition and the fact that Rehan is, you know, sort of the Adil Rashid's mini-me, and Adil Rashid is going to play, and Hartley is offering you something else as a left-arm spinner?
I think so, yeah. I think listening to Key talk this morning, it sounded like they don't really see a world in which Rehan and Rashid are playing in the same team and both adding a lot of value. I think particularly when you consider that England
Try that in the Caribbean.
They tried it, and I think Rehan sort of tailed off during that tour. He started pretty well in the ODIs, as I remember it, and then his returns kind of tailed off through the series. It is a little bit strange for sure, given that Hartley didn't play on that white ball tour. I think he was with the ODI squad only and didn't feature in that series. So it is a little odd on that basis. Like, you know, you'd hope that he's not going to get thrown to the wolves and suddenly be brought in to make his debut in a T20 World Cup semi-final or something like that. But I think, it strikes me as a selection where, because England have those bowling options in the top six or seven as well, with Jacks, Livingston and Moeen, there's a world in which they could all play. If you want extra spin overs, you probably want someone who's going to complement what you already have. And I suppose Hartley can also bowl in the power play, he's proved in domestic cricket, which I think could be relevant. You know, trying to work out the balance of a team where you had maybe two frontline quicks and Sam Curran or three frontline quicks. I don't know how exactly you do it, but you can see the value of potentially having Hartley bowl to a pair of right-handers in the power play, say Kohli and Rohit or whatever it might be when you get that deep. I think it's maybe on the face of it a slight surprise, but I think given Hartley's historic record in white ball cricket and given he does offer something slightly different as a skill set, I can see the logic to it.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to echo a lot of Matt's sentiments there. You consider that he is an accomplished white ball player. The reason he keeps on that Test tour is because of his height, but he's an accomplished white ball player, certainly domestically anyway. And, you know, while there's a conversation to be had about, or certainly something that I mentioned at the top of the show about knowing, you know, what bowlers are going to fill certain roles, particularly with Chris Wokes as a new ball bowler not in the squad, well, there's at least two new, power play overs from Hartley, who's accustomed to open the bowling in white ball cricket. So, and also he's a good batter. And while, you know, Rehan is certainly a very exciting batter and, like, you know, thrills because of his wrist work and things like that, and is, you know, very, very accomplished at hitting boundaries, so is Tom Hartley.
Just ask R. Ashwin. the sort of potential makeup of an 11 then, Matt, I mean, you're looking at kind of, I guess, similar to that team that played in the Caribbean before Christmas. There was no Bairstow there, but kind of Livingston, Brook and Moeen is kind of the finishing, you know, engine room. And then the bowling, depending on, you know, Archer, fingers crossed, is there as a sort of extra pace, Topley's left arm. And you've got Jordan or Curran adding depth to the batting.
Yeah.
Rashid would mention.
I'll be interested to see exactly what happens with the number eight spot. I think that is a sort of hinge position for England, where Key was speaking a lot today about the importance from his perspective of having batting depth. I think clearly there's a lot of intrigue heading into this World Cup about how much of the IPL's massive uplift in scores this season has been down to pitches, the impact player rule, which has turned it, you know, means every team bats one position deeper, balls, boundary sizes, conditions, which are the variables that are going to transfer over? Are batters now incredibly fearless compared to what they were 2 years ago, or is it a product of batting depth? And I think he clearly thinks that if England are going to be successful, then they need to have some like a proper batter at number eight, which kind of fits with the philosophy they've had for a long time. For example, it's difficult to see them having a team where you'd have Wood, Topley, Archer and Rashid from 8 to 11. I think that would be a slightly too long a tail, which then probably means that either Curran or Jordan or potentially Hartley on particular pitches could bat at number eight. I think that's about right for the rough outline. Interesting to see Bairstow, how he goes at number four. He's not played that much T20 cricket over the past, well, since his leg break, basically. And obviously, straight before his leg break, he was due to be promoted back to the top of the order of that T20 World Cup when Alex Hales eventually came in his place, having spent 18 months or so at number four in England's T20 side. So definitely be an interesting one. And if you were the opposition's analyst looking at how you're preparing against England, you'd say that's a lot of right-handers in a row. They might well chuck Moeen or Curran up, for example. But you'd probably be picking your slow left armour in every game if you've got one in the squad and you're coming up against England, I think.
And then reflecting on that Caribbean series, Gudakesh Moti had a pretty good
and Hussain
time
as well, because they quite often play too.
Yes. There are clear like pointers there, as Kanaki mentioned, Vish, the Caribbean slugfest. England won the two high scoring games, or the two highest scoring games. They made their second highest T20 high score by a full member, 267 for 3. Phil Salt scoring 100, and then Phil Salt also scoring 100 in their second highest successful chase of 226 for 3, a game in which Harry Brooke finished Andre Russell right at the end with 30 off 7 balls or something. But the three, they lost that series 3-2, and it was the lower scoring games where they had more problems, and that's sort of always been the way since the kind of Morgan white ball revolution, that calibrating the approach for those stickier conditions is going to be the challenge, you know, in a knockout competition.
Yeah, and I suppose when you're put in that situation, England's perceived weakness is essentially an arrogance, really, isn't it? That like I know it's tough, but we can probably if we try a little bit harder. Or we try and hit it a little bit further, we will get to that position. There's a lot of talk about people not knocking it around. Joe Root's name's always mentioned in that kind of conversation. And I think what you do have in this squad, particularly with that starting 11, is a set of players who are actually pretty comfortable in making up time, or certainly making up dot balls, as it were, or making up, you know, ones and twos that they'd rather have fours and sixes. And I think that's quite important, because it essentially gives your opposition a sense that you never really settle down. Whereas I think previously, when England have got into that stage, there's probably a perception that, right, they're probably in their own heads here. I don't think you're going to get that initially from this England team, particularly given the amount of cricket that the more inexperienced players have played across the world. And I suppose that's where the tail comes into view then, doesn't it, with regards to, I suppose, who that number eight is and just how many batters you want to plough into that lineup. Which actually brings me to a point that I thought about earlier when Matt was discussing the 11. Livingston's an interesting one, though. He remains a fascinating cricketer because we all know what he can do, because he's essentially a walking highlight reel, and you don't really know what to expect from him. He kind of, when Matt and I were discussing the makeup of that squad yesterday, and, you know, trying to piece it together when we realised that Chris Jordan was going to be in, we were kind of thinking about people who would drop out. And I never thought that Livingston would be the one in that original list that we had that would drop out. And yet at the same time, I was like, oh God, like he could also have a stinker, because that's the nature of this format and that's the nature of him as a player. So it feels like there is a lot riding on him in terms of balance. If England want to go with, you know, Tom Hartley at eight, or if they want to, you know, throw in, say, like a Sam Curran potentially. So I don't really know what to expect from him, but I know if he does well, England probably win the tournament.
He's a really interesting point in his career, I think, because you know, if he retired tomorrow, he'd retire with a lot of pretty good achievements that almost everyone would be happy with. He's, you know, he's got a test cap. His caps across all three formats. He scored one of the great T20 100s for England at Trent Bridge against Pakistan. He's got an unbelievable highlights reel, as you say. He was the highest paid overseas player at an IPL auction. You know, there's a lot there. He won a T20 World Cup. He was in the middle.
Yeah.
In
100 MVP in the
100 MVP. He has achieved a lot. But then I suppose he's at that point in his career, into his 30s now, where he's thinking, you know, I suppose the question is what he wants to do now, because if he, you know, it feels like he could definitely play a major role in several tournaments for a long period of time. He was part of the sort of next gen, the refresh of the original Morgan side. And it feels like he's at a point where, having had a pretty poor World Cup in India in the 50 over tournament before Christmas, I don't know. It does feel like a hinge point. He could become an integral part of the England side for the next 5 years. He could also fall by the wayside quite quickly. And he's had a pretty mixed winter as well. He's currently out of the Punjab team at the time of recording. He really struggled in the SA20. But England have constantly wanted to pick him because of the balance that he offers and because of the ceiling that they know he has, even though the floor is sometimes quite low as well. So, it'd be really, really interesting to see how he goes in conditions that probably should suit his style of player pretty well.
Do you think England, with that prospective top five, are now, well, will be less reliant on him, which will help him?
Yeah, it's so tricky because of the fact that he's become this sort of designated finisher for them. And he did bat a number four briefly before Christmas in the Caribbean, but I think he's going to go back to six now by the seams of it. But I think this is a sort of a general problem that some finishers have, or some people who are probably more players who have got experience of being proper batters, if you like, across formats, and then suddenly become typecast as T20 finishers, where you probably rely on the rhythm of having face balls in a way that someone like a Pollard or David never does, because they never really had the first class career grounding them. And then suddenly you're having to adjust to this new, you know, lifestyle almost of playing, of, you know, facing between, let's say, 5 and 20 balls most innings. You know, Livingston went through this huge stretch of time last year where he didn't face even 50 balls in an innings, and he was coming in at, you know, 7 for Lancashire in the Blast because he wanted to prep to be a finisher. But it is tricky, and I think we often have seen that in T20 World Cups. People who are number six for their country, you know, he might go through the group stage where you play Oman, Namibia, Scotland, and Australia. He might only bat once. He might be more of a bowler at the start, and then suddenly you have 3 Super 8 games in 5 days, and England are 50 for 4, let's say, on a tough pitch, and Livingston walks out with, you know, you have to train well in that situation to be in a point where you've hit enough balls and you've got some rhythm and you have something to fall back on, rather than walking out for your first hit in weeks and thinking, oh, I'm in a bit of trouble here.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting. And I suppose, to zoom out as well, this is a really weird tournament in terms of how it's structured. You have four
That was going to be my next question to you, Maz. Yeah. Explain what we're getting into.
Yeah, well, you have...
It'd be a good time for a graphic, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, England have
20 teams at this tournament.
Yeah, they have 4 relatively low-stakes games in the first 2 weeks against...
Albeit one of them is against Australia.
Against 3 associates and Australia. And the weirdness of this tournament is that the seeding for the Super 8 round is pre-done. So if England and Australia qualify as the top two, it doesn't actually matter at all to anyone what order that happens in. They'll go through to, they'll go through as A1.
Please, they're designated.
Which is really strange, because it's there is limited pressure on those first 2 weeks if you beat the teams that England should obviously definitely beat in terms of resources and player pool. They're not always guaranteed to. They have a proud history in T20 World Cups of screwing things up against teams that they should beat.
Scotland supporters listening, yeah, Pricking their ears up at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And the David Visa fan club as well, no doubt. But and then suddenly you have 3 Super 8 games in the space of 5 days, with I think 1 flight on one of the days in between as well. So you have 3 very, very high stakes games against I think likely to be Pakistan, South Africa, and then harder to call the other group, but potentially West Indies or New Zealand or Afghanistan, in a very short space of time. And then it spreads out again a little bit more, but the semi-final venues of Trinidad and Guyana, which tend to suit spin a bit more, which probably doesn't play into England's hands. So you can see how it could look great for 2 weeks and unravel quite quickly. You could see how it would be a sort of quiet start, and then suddenly England are on a roll and they've won three in a row and are heading into a semi. It is going to be a strange comp, and I think I don't think there's a clear favourite at all. I think there's a lot of dangerous teams, none of whom are completely settled or polished, and obviously everyone's, you know, no one's had a long block of T20 eyes, with the possible exception of Pakistan, to prepare for it, because almost everyone has a lot of players involved at the IPL.
Just on the what this World Cup means for the leadership group and so on, Vish, I mean, Mott and Butler kind of avoided carrying the can for the failed 50-over World Cup defence, but...
What were you reading?
Well, I mean,
they're still there, yeah.
Fingers were pointed, but, you know. what do England need to do other than defend their trophy out in the Caribbean for, you know... I mean, Butler might then just decide of his own accord that he's, you know, done the job for long enough. But Matthew Mott's contracted for, what, another couple of years?
Yeah.
What's the minimum expectation this time around?
I suppose the minimum expectation is, if not winning it, then, you know, glorious failure in the semis or even in the final, obviously. I think ultimately what it will come down to is how much truck they would have for the job, regardless actually if whether they win it. I imagine if they win it, Mott is likely to stay on, and if they don't, I suppose it might even be a situation where he thinks, you know what, it's probably not worth the hassle. We've got umpteen amounts of grief, and you know, after the 50-over World Cup, you know, you kind of, you know, he did an interview in the Times where it felt like that kind of came across. So, you know, maybe reading a bit too much between the lines of him saying that he wants to do the job and he's focused on it. I think there was also a lot of talk of, I suppose, about the criticism that he got in India, and, you know, to even bring it, obviously he would, you know, we know the nature of these interviews. He was asked about it. He spoke about it, but the way he spoke about it struck to me as someone who was not quite done with it, but thought it was broadly unnecessary and didn't need it in his life. And, you know, fair play to him, who does. But I think it was also a little bit of a misnomer. He's clearly a very good coach, and he's someone who is in this weird space at the moment because of the way the test team is, and, you know, how often he has access to his team, which I suppose makes the players returning from the IPL as early as they are, you know, it's also learning from a mistake after, you know, from the 50-over World Cup at the end of last year. And I suppose, like, how much truck he has for bringing through what is a newer generation of squad through. I think it's, again, we spoke about it at the start, but it is a more exciting squad. It is a more malleable squad as well. Less people, you know, fewer players set in their ways to a degree. And as for Joss, I mean, you kind of hope he sticks around for another couple of years, certainly as long as Mott does, because beyond him, who are, you know, what are the other options? There's talk of Harry Brook, but then I feel like we might even be going back to a stage of grooming a test captain through white ball captaincy, which isn't necessarily advisable, particularly with how the paths are moving so separate at the moment. But, I mean, Brook seems to be the only option, and I don't think he needs it right now.
The only other name I'd throw in there would be Sam Curran, but he needs to be at a point where his performances demand selection across both 50-over and T20 cricket, probably before that happens, because he's done some captaincy for Punjab and for over Invincibles and for Surrey, but and is therefore one of the very few young English players with some captaincy experience in white ball cricket. But I feel like, I don't know, it feels hard to see him captaining in, you know, September, for example, against Australia, and Butler being either back in the ranks or having quit. I can't quite picture that. So I reckon Butler's here for a couple more years.
Yeah. I mean, it shows how much the format fluctuates. I feel like it was only last summer, during the Ashes maybe, where you spoke to Sam Curran, didn't you? But you know, and you asked him reasonably if international captaincy was, you know, certainly on the horizon for him, and he was all
over. I actually think, from what I've seen, Curran is a really good captain, and I actually think that, you know, arguably that's the best facet of his game at the moment, because he's not been in great form. He's actually had an okay IPO, I think, with both bat and ball, but Throughout the winter, he struggled at times. He had a bit of a walk-on role at the World Cup and walked off pretty quickly. I think he does have something as a captain. He seems to make quite a lot of good calls. It does still feel like he's maybe a year or two away. I think Mott is the man who's likely to come under more scrutiny. And I think that's also partly just the nature of international coaching at the moment. It's such a weird thing. When you think about the sort of almost how easy franchise coaching seems to be by contrast, and that there's always a job, you can be away from home for a short period of time and nothing else. You can sort of dip your toes into tournaments for a period of the year and then sort of keep it going on the back burner, versus Mott, who's gone through these extremes of nothing to do for 3 months and then suddenly 2 months on tour with a press pack that cares and with TV down his throat and, people actually giving him quite a lot of grief for most of that World Cup in India. You can see how it's not actually that appetizing a role compared to the franchise circuit. So I don't know.
Well, you look at who Pakistan have appointed as their test and level coaches, two people who people were talking about for the England job maybe about a few years ago, who then kind of went through, well, certainly one of them went through the franchise setup, another one tried to, and I suppose did in parts. And then once they couldn't get gigs, we're like, well, back into international cricket.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Back then to the less than warm embrace of the county championship. After four rounds, defending champions Surrey have moved ominously to the top of the standings, albeit they are locked level with Essex, who might have won 4 from 4, but for the weather. In fact, so dismally damp has it been that only 7 matches have produced a result. Anyway, let's hear from Surrey's Dan Worrell, who rounded up 8 for 91 in a thrashing of Hampshire and afterwards spoke to Matt.
Dan, you must have been really satisfied with that. Yeah, definitely. Anytime you can win a game by an innings, it's a pretty special feat. And I think as a bowling group, in fact, as a whole team, we perform almost as well as we can. Put a full stop there and try again in a couple of weeks.
For you personally, to bring up 100 first-class wickets for Surrey, take a 5 from the final day, must be pretty exciting stuff, pretty special.
Yeah, it's... I'm just lucky that I have got to play for Surrey long enough to get 100 wickets. I think it's something I wish I'd have done 10 years ago, to be honest. But it's nice to be where I am now and chasing a third championship.
This must be the sort of thing you had in mind when you came over in 22, the idea of, obviously going back-to-back and winning a game early on the fourth day, having the afternoon to enjoy the sunshine and celebrate in London.
Yeah, well, it's something that wasn't even on my radar when I came over, but just as a club, I'm so privileged to be part of it, and any little bit that I can do to repay the faith is something that I'll be proud to do for as long as I'll have it.
You mentioned sort of wishing you come over earlier. How different have you found it bowling over here compared to back over the Shield? Obviously, two very different competitions, two different styles of bowling. Maybe this one suits you even more than the Shield did.
Yeah, well, I played a few seasons as an overseas at Gloucestershire, so had a decent taste of county cricket. But it's just a very different way of preparing, of playing. There's a lot more cricket here with a lot less rest. But then you play and it's not as taxing on your body as the same bowler as it is in Australia, given the heat and flat pitches and Kookaburra bowled. But it is what it is. I just try my best every time I go out there.
I was going to ask as well, where are you at with England qualification? Is that next year?
It's twice I've been asked this week, and there's still at least 300 overs to bowl before that had been considered. But yeah, the way the rules are, it's 3 years since being a local player in England.
So it's at the start of 25. Yeah. And is that sort of vaguely with your radar?
I mean, I'm ready to go. I'm required. I've learned in my time that as soon as you've seen that far ahead, you're kidding yourself. So I'll get right, get fit, and then be ready for the game against Warwickshire in a couple of weeks.
Vish, let's get real here. Dan Frankie Worrell is not going to do a Darren Patterson, is he?
Why not? Imagine if he lines up in the Ashes. That'd be so good. I suppose he won't do a Darren Patterson.
Because he would only play once and then
disappear forever, but he might... What am I even saying? He might be a good Ryan Sidebottom alike, and I mean the English Ryan Sidebottom than the Australian Ryan Sidebottom who played for Warwickshire, who were also, you know, he grabbed the intrigue of selector Ed Smith. And was also
an Australian
someone
who could have qualified.
Yes,
for
and then
England.
He also could have qualified for England. But I mean, the Ryan Sidebottom who played for England, who basically ended up being a stopgap between
a perfect sort of 2
essentially
years.
The you know the 2005 Ashes and Broad and Anderson.
Yeah,
which was actually a really valuable role because there was a point where there didn't seem to be any way of gaining some kind of continuity with selection. And he provided that, at least from one end, you know, at least for a certain set of overs in a test. And it feels like England might be on the cusp of that. Bear in mind that, obviously, Chris Wokes is left out of the World Cup squad. He mentioned, obviously, that his future is there in test cricket, certainly this summer, certainly next summer, because he's on a 2-year deal.
Yeah.
But there'll be a situation where England don't really know through either availability through injury, and age as well, who their kind of their starting three or four would be in a test match, certainly a year in advance. And I don't think we've had that situation in a long, long time. So why not? I mean, he's exceptionally good. He obviously is bowling on a pitch that is generally less amenable to seam than around the country. Obviously, the conditions aside, he is someone who gets out the best batters in the world through his own skill. Certainly the best batters playing county championship on that given week with his skill. But no, I think he's a quality bowler. I've seen him for a while. He's tall as well. He's quick enough, which I think matters mostly over here.
Is he quicker than Sam Cooke?
Yeah, he's quicker than... Yeah, he is quicker than Sam Cooke. But I suppose like that's just a conversation for the selectors to have themselves. I think just given what Rob Key is like, I don't think he will see it as a barrier of entry into England's selection conversations that he has 3 ODIs for Australia, that he is Australian. But
he is Martin McCaig.
But I suppose the...
Although Martin McCaig didn't have the caps.
But. Right. But the bigger picture there is, are we, you know, is there an element of bed blocking in picking a guy who'd be 33 at the time for essentially 2 years, a real short-term pick when that could be used to, you know, freshen things up with someone else, someone younger.
Matt Potts and Sam Cooke and so on. And
yeah, the only thing that makes me think it's a remote possibility is the fact that there's an away Ashes in Australia coming up. He would potentially have a home summer and then going into that Ashes. And I don't think, I mean, you know, people have said this before previous Ashes tours and been proven wrong, but I don't think either Anderson or Wokes is a likely candidate for that Ashes tour at this stage.
Famous last words.
That could be completely wrong, but that's my thought anyway at the moment. And given Broll's experience bowling in Australia, where he did pretty well but not shoot the lights out in the Shield.
Yeah, I mean, he has just told us how he likes bowling over here.
Yeah.
Because it's easier, basically.
But that's the only thing that makes me think it's a possibility. I think, to be honest, I think, you know, qualifying for England at 33, I don't know how quick he is compared to Sam Cooke, but I don't think he's rapid by any means.
No, he's
like
not,
low to mid-80s, probably. Yeah, I don't know. I can't quite see it. I think given everything that, you know, we've mentioned already in this pod, but about, you know, Key looking for this next generation of currently 20-something fast bowlers who England can build an attack around for a number of years, like Australia have with Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood, it does feel like it would be, as much as anything, a bit of a backward step to say, actually, we'll go short-term stopgap Worrall for 2 summers, but who knows? It would be a hell of a story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we will definitely be all over
and
it.
And to be honest, you know, it wasn't... Obviously, I asked him a question at the end there, but it wasn't hugely on my radar. It was something I thought I should ask rather than something that I thought was... And the main story with Dan Worrall is that he's been an absolutely unbelievable signing since he joined Surrey. He's now 101 wickets at 22 for them in the Championship. He's played 2 full seasons of Championship cricket for them and won the title both times. He's lost probably 3 games across those 2 seasons, and I think 2 of them were after Surrey had already won the title. He's going for 3 in a row. He's now also You know, he won the SA20 earlier in the year and has developed a bit of a sort of freelance T20 stuff going on in the winter. So,
which wouldn't have happened if he stayed in Australia.
Which is
the important point with this as well. It's like he hasn't moved to qualify for England. He's moved to make the most out of his career.
Yeah.
Like, and it makes 12 months a year.
It makes a lot of sense. Because if you're predominantly a Red Bull bowler in Australia, the Shield isn't a particularly rewarding system in terms of... You play starting end of the summer, then there's a big break in the middle. I mean, you could say that's the same with the Championship, but it's a bit more consistent through the summer. And also, there are slightly more opportunities to play one cricket
more games
in England.
There's more games. A treadmill.
But... Yeah, and there's more opportunities to play white ball. If he didn't have a Big Bash contract and he was sort of on the periphery of a few teams, I think, by the end.
Well, there was the biggest controversy about him leaving was... giving up his striker's gig,
yeah,
I think, because there was a sense that they wanted, they could have assumed he'd be there for another couple of seasons, and he just pulled the pin on it.
I don't know. I think it's I think the main story is that Dan Morrill was very good, and so is Surrey, rather than Dan Morrill was going to play for England next summer.
Yes,
I think to be fair, I'm reading between the lines again, but I think he said he wanted to stick it to those Aussies to show them how good he was.
I think he said something about convicts over there.
The rat who joined a sinking ship part two. Aside from that heartwarming story, Surrey looking pretty good again, Vish. We've touched on this, but albeit that Essex are going to give them a good run for their money, and the final game of the season, if it isn't all decided by then, is at Chelmsford, Essex at Surrey, Essex hosting Surrey. So
yeah,
and Alan they played for the twice this year. Supercomputer has done us a job.
Yeah, I mean that's huge. I think what's been good is they've had dominance over a few seasons now, because you'd have legitimate questions to ask about, I suppose, the fairness. I mean, you still do, to be fair, but the fairness of Div 1, the fact that you don't play everyone twice, and they, you know, didn't play Lancashire twice, they didn't play Essex twice, so they're in this.
They do it this year, then.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, well, and
I'm sure they're not playing twice, but they're definitely playing Essex twice.
And because of the lack of flux, really, with those Division 1 teams, in terms of, you know who's going to be in contention for relegation. The only, I suppose, quote unquote, red herring at the moment is Lancashire sitting bottom, but. You know who's going to be in the middle, and you know it's going to be Surrey and Essex at the top. So that's kind of how it's playing out now. And, you know, the availability thing will be interesting come, not just the World Cup, but obviously the Test Series as well. That in itself might throw up a few issues, because Surrey will be more affected than Essex. But, yeah, I mean, it's been pretty dull. And I don't blame the Kookaburra. I probably do blame the weather a fair bit. I think there's a few teams who you'd have liked to see have a bit more ambition, but, you know, it's easy to say that from in here rather than sat in a dressing room, having been, you know, sat through the rain and, you know, pitches that don't seem to be doing much at the moment, but it's been probably quite an underwhelming start to the season, all told.
I think it's worth mentioning when you talk about sustained dominance, Surrey have played Hampshire 4 years in a row in games that have started in April at the Oval, and three of them they've won by an innings, and the other they won by 9 wickets. So that is sustained dominance over what has generally been a pretty good Hampshire team as well, if you think of the attack that they've had.
They have been in the mix, haven't they? Elsewhere, there's not really much to look at because it's been draws.
Leicester are
top of Division 2.
Yeah, yes, but they've not won a game.
No, because only two teams have won a game in that division, and Sussex.
That's very. Was it the 94 World Cup? Where there was a team
who Bulgaria qualified,
something like that. Yeah.
Three draws. I don't know, but yeah, Sussex didn't play this fourth round, and they were top and have won a game. The other team to have won a game is
Middlesex over Yorkshire.
That's right.
I was there.
And Yorkshire have had the benefit of Harry Book and Joe Root knocking around. Both.
That's been great use, hasn't it?
Yeah, no wins thus far. but yes, beyond that, it's been, we had a lot to talk about with the Kookaburra. the Dukes is back, but it hasn't resulted in a ton of results.
This is also why, to be honest, I have never quite understood the resistance from going from 14 games to 10, because a lot of teams have now played four games, and it's still really, really cold outside, and no one's really going to the grounds because it's pretty horrible, even though the games are being played over weekends. You know, it doesn't to me feel like it would be massively different if you went down to 10 from the status quo, but that's a personal opinion.
Yeah, I mean, don't say that within earshot of the members.
It's at MR Roller 98. For I'll take you up on that.
Yeah, you don't want fewer games, you just want them all in the middle of the summer. Okay, well, plenty of race left to run there. We've also had the start of the women's domestic season with the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy underway, as well as the announcement of those counties awarded Tier 1 status for next season's new structure. For the latest, search out our dedicated Women's Cricket podcast, ESPN Cricket Info Power Play, and subscribe via your preferred pod provider.
Can I say one really weird thing about regional cricket, which is that this week, the England
Please
players,
do. I hope it is weird, though.
They're missing the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy to go on a team-building camp to the Lake District. They're centrally contracted England players, which is, I don't know, I find quite extraordinary. I know that the regional system as it is funded centrally.
It's on the way out, so.
It is obviously, in its final season as the status quo. But I do find it very weird that as a competition that the ECB are running, they're then pulling all the best players out of so that they can... especially because they spent however many weeks in New Zealand. That was quite a long tour to New Zealand, and it seemed like they played a fair bit of golf and had some coffees and everything there. So I don't know. I thought it was a bit odd.
They're going to be fighting each other like England did before the 10-11 Ashes in Bavarian Forest. Didn't several of the sort of England contracted players miss around the first round for Tammy Beaumont's wedding?
Yeah, which you got to think that's a scheduling problem from Tammy.
Wouldn't fly in club cricket, would it?
Final thoughts before we wrap up. We've touched on the IPL, but it has been a record-breaking tournament on the run scoring front. I'm going to try not to sound like I'm doing a bad Kiwi accent when I ask this, but Matt, how much 60 cricket is too much 60 cricket?
That was a competition off the back of the CPL, wasn't it?
The 60, I don't know. I personally don't hate six hitting, 500 play, 250 plays, 250 games as much as some people seem to find them quite monotonous. I think more is more for you. I don't necessarily think that, and I think the ideal T20 season, whichever it is, has a range of pitches, range of conditions, range of players doing well, types of players doing well. But I do think it is still really, really fun watching a team chase down 260 with an over to spare, even if there are some plinked miss hit sixes that go 70 metres and just about clear a fielder. Personally, I think, for some reason, cricket is wedded to this idea of a balance between bat and ball, and an idea that if a certain number of runs are scored, it's too many. Whereas I've never really viewed it in that way. And as long as the teams are relatively evenly matched, and as long as it's a good game, I would always rather see 250 plays 250 than I would see 180 plays 120, because teams are poorly matched. So I think the good thing in the IPL this season is we've had quite a lot of close games. My opinion has always been that those higher scoring games, if anything, elevate the best bowlers. Like, there have been a couple of games where some risers have scored 260, 270, I think. Did they touch 280 once?
I think that's the highest score, isn't it?
But in a couple of those games,
there have been lots of records broken.
They've been a bit sketchy when defending those totals, and then Pat Cummins has come on and bowled four overs, one for 35 or four for 40.
10 and over or 9 and over or something.
He has been the best bowler on either side, and he's won them the game.
But then, like, what is the problem with that? I kind of agree with Matt on two things there. The balance between bat and ball, it's like people want that every single delivery. it's got to be 50-50 when the ball goes
out. It has to be a good
down.
Ball and it has to be well played.
Yeah, all right, we'll give you three balls, one over to you, and you can have the bat can have the other three balls. But also, like, this idea that, who'd be a bowler going at 10 and over?
Yeah.
I was like, well, have you seen their bank balance?
Yeah, they're doing all right.
It's the idea that, like, no, six and under six and over is good, and over six and over is bad. it's like you just tally it with the scoreboard, don't you? Yeah. Or we get it with the overall, you know, the inning score as well. So, you know, in the Premier League this season, there are more goals, and you know the average goals are up.
That's the balance between attack and defence.
Well, exactly. Excuse. Yeah, yeah. It's just it's a bit of a strange.
No one grows up wanting to be a goalkeeper anymore.
Actually, I fundamentally believe that. Yeah. Everyone grows up to be a third goalkeeper.
Yeah. In our editor's words, it's not a question of Sambit Ballas is writing over the weekend. It's not about bat and ball, it's bat v bat, it's become, although I don't think he was
Or team v team, like a team sport.
Yes, well...
but it comes down to preference,
doesn't
it?
That's not what cricket is,
isn't it? Yeah, yeah, and some people won't.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would probably enjoy a 120 players, 120 game at Chepauk more than most fans, because we're probably watching it for slight, you know, a lot of
because we're watching it properly. Yeah,
we're real nerds.
Yeah. But like, you know, if you go and watch from a stadium a 120 players 120 game, it's generally not very fun. It's much more enjoyable to watch on TV where you can actually see what's going on, rather than, you know, if you're in a stadium, it's much more enjoyable if you're seeing people hit sixes, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, like there are comedians I don't like who sell out stadiums, and I'm not going to go out there and boycott them.
Yeah.
Well, I think the IPL's still doing all right, isn't it?
Exactly. I think I'll survive.
Two quick questions to finish on. And Matt, you can get the technical one. Is the impact player the impact sub rule, which is clearly part of this with the elevated scoring rates, a good thing, a bad thing for India?
Well,
generally, you know, terrible.
I'm torn between. I think one of two things will happen. when/if India fail to win the T20 World Cup in June, which is either the impact player rule will be scrapped and blamed for them losing, or the impact player rule will become universal in T20 international cricket at the BCCI's encouragement. Because I do think it's weird that India's player pool seems sort of uniquely poorly suited to then be the country that's saying we don't actually want all-rounders. Or, you know, it basically reflects the player pool. They don't have very many all-rounders compared to a lot of countries. The squad balance at the World Cup is going to be pretty heavily reliant on Hardik being fit enough to bowl. And they're probably going to have Jadeja at number 7, who's clearly a very good all-rounder, but then they might have four number 11s beneath him. It feels like India should either get rid of this rule from the BCCI's point of view, get rid of the rule and then therefore encourage the development of more all-rounders, or try and lobby to make this universal so that not having so many all-rounders in their player pool doesn't actually matter as much. So that's why I think it will go one of two ways.
Very good. That's a very sensible answer. Vish, Jake Fraser-McGurk, or Jake Fraser-Berserk, as we'll all be calling him, is he the perfect T20 batter / most exciting thing that you've seen in the last couple of weeks?
I probably have to say yes, don't I? Yeah. Am I contractually obliged to say yes?
He's a filthy slogger. I actually don't think he's perfect T20 batter, because T20...
I mean, he tries to hit...
He might be the perfect IPL batter.
75% of his deliveries in the IPL, he's tried to hit...
But he's got the perfect balance between Fraser and McGurk.
he might be the perfect IPL batter, I think, because you can generally get away with it on roads. But I think in the... You know, we saw in the last T20 World Cup in Australia, you know, you had to have a technique and had to be able to play the short ball and couldn't just rely on boundary hitting. So I wonder if he'll end up having a better career in India than he does in his home conditions in Australia.
Also, you got to think about how valuable being new is on the scene in terms of how little information people have on you. And, you know, it's really exciting to see. It's quite cool. I think the other thing about it is like seeing young players do this kind of stuff, you know, whether it's him or Stubbs, is actually kind of better for the game, because with all due respect to the Pollards and, you know, whoever else is of this world, like, I think one of the big issues with global franchise cricket has been the same faces over and over and over again. So, you know, the more other countries or other players that can come into it and freshen it up a bit, the better.
Very good. He's all right, but he's not got a proper technique. That's the conclusion from
Jeffrey
that
Roller.
Lovely. Okay, that's a wrap then for this week. The English summer should start to warm up, fingers crossed, with the arrival of Pakistan for a T20I series next month. And we'll, of course, be across all the build-up to the World Cup, as well as delivering drip-by-drip coverage of the Championship. For now, my thanks to Matt and Vish, and to you all for tuning in to the Switch It podcast on ESPNcricinfo.com.